Chapter 21.
Living in New York City wasn't easy. Sometimes my nerves felt like grated cheese, but it was never boring. I liked that. Something was always happening in Manhattan, good or bad. There were things to do almost any hour of the day or night. There's a bookstore on practically every corner in New York City. I read the books furtively until I realized nobody cared if I hung out for hours. I only read the poetry and fiction. I didn't want to discover I wasn't smart enough to understand nonfiction. But the women's studies section tempted me. By leafing through the books, I could eavesdrop on the discussions going on between women without being seen. It turned out to be true that I couldn't understand a lot of the theory. But I felt as though I was rushing into a burning building to rescue the ideas I needed in my own life. At first, I skimmed past all the words and pages about reproductive rights. I had no relationship to my own uterus, but I remembered how upset Teresa had been after I got busted in Rochester because she couldn't remember when she had her last period. I never kept track of my menstrual cycle, but Teresa always knew when my period was in relation to hers. It suddenly made sense to me. She was afraid I might have gotten pregnant. The idea had never occurred to me. What would I have done if I'd gotten pregnant after a rape? I stopped skipping over the sections in books about women controlling their own bodies. Maybe all of these things that were so important to other women would prove to have meaning for me too. No matter how much I read at the bookstores, I always ended up spending a lot of my paychecks on books. I also discovered classical music. On my way to work one morning, I stood and listened to a man playing the cello in the subway station. The music grabbed me by the collar and wouldn't let me go. I crouched down next to the pillar nearest him as he played. The music articulated emotions for me the way poetry did. When the rush hour crowd thinned, I realized I was late for work. The musician put down his bow and wiped his brow. "What were you playing?" I asked him. He smiled. "Mozart." I began to haunt music stores as well. I scraped together enough money for a stereo. I also explored reggae and merengue, charanga y guaguancó, jazz and blues. One spring afternoon, I found myself scrubbing my apartment. I had turned up Pachelbel's Canon in D major full blast. I realized I was changing on the inside as much as I was on the outside. "If you're an organizer for Local 6," the owner leaned across his desk, "you can punch in, but you may not punch out." Ironic. He was afraid the union had sent me to organize his typesetters. I was afraid he'd find out I'd only recently learned to type. The foreman led me to a machine. "Here's the manual. I don't have time to train you now. Start typing this text. When it's done, run it out and give it to the proofreaders in there. I'll show you the format codes later, or look them up. Got it?" I nodded. "Wait," I stopped him. "How do I run it out?" He shook his head disgustedly. "That's what you got a manual for." From where I typeset, I could see four women working inside the proofreader's room. I could hear their laughter, easy and relaxed. The foreman poked his head in and said something I couldn't hear. They broke off their conversation. One woman nodded. He left. Their laughter rose again. I wondered if men know that women talk differently among themselves. I guessed the same must be true for the Black and Latino workers too, when no whites were around. The women huddled to share a secret. I typed up the text and looked up the codes to run it out. I actually looked forward to being inside the proofreader space for a moment, women's space. The women stopped talking as I walked in. I held up the repros. "Put them over there," one of the women said. She didn't look at me as she spoke. I sighed, dropped them in the basket, and left. As I walked away, I heard their conversation resume and their voices rise in laughter once again. I only lasted one shift in that shop, but New York City was chock full of typesetting shops that ran round the clock. They were always hiring on third shift, lobster shift. After faking my way into enough shops and learning a bit at each, I soon realized I wasn't bluffing any longer. I had become a typesetter. It wasn't a bad rhythm of life. For 6 or 8 months out of the year, I earned top dollar. I loved the leisurely pre-dawn ride home, traveling in the opposite direction of packed rush hour trains and crowded streets. But it was dark when I got up, and I began to feel like a mole. Just when I thought I'd lose my sanity, it was summertime, layoffs. I became eligible for the maximum unemployment benefits. During the summer, I explored the city. My biggest problem was loneliness. I didn't have anyone to talk to all summer long. By fall, I longed for casual conversation between coworkers. Bill pounded the lunchroom table for emphasis. I read the newspaper. "Isn't that the truth?" Bill asked me. He leaned forward. "It's too fucking weird working nights in a plant with no windows. You could come out in the morning and find out there's been a nuclear meltdown and you never even knew it." Jim laughed. "Well, if you see the sun rising in the west, come back and tell the rest of us, okay?" Jim sighed. "I know what you mean, though. I remember one time I came out of work at dawn and there was 2 feet of snow on the ground. I didn't even know it was going to snow. I felt like I missed something the whole rest of the world saw and I was somewhere else." "It's like working in a fucking submarine," Bill agreed. "You know what I hate the most?" Jim continued. "I get so disoriented about which is today and when is tomorrow. When I get up at night to go to work, my girlfriend says she'll see me tomorrow. But for me, I'm going to see her later today." I nodded. "I know exactly what you mean. I feel like I'm living between the cracks of today and tomorrow." "Ooh," Bill said. "I like that. Can I quote you?" We all laughed. "You know what I really hate about shift work?" I said. "The way the whole world is geared to first shift. When I get off work, I don't want bacon and eggs. I want steak and baked potato. I want dinner." "Yeah," Jim chimed in. "And I want to see a movie. And go dancing with my old lady at a club so wild it stays open past noon," Bill said. "And when I turn on TV," I added, "I don't want to see game shows and soap operas. It's depressing." "Hey, guy," Bill said, "why don't you come to the gym with us in the morning? We go swimming right after work. They got a steam room, too. We can get you in on a pass." It sounded like heaven, but I fumbled for an excuse. "I don't have a swimsuit or towel or anything. Maybe another time." Jim cut me off. "They got towels there. Hell, they wouldn't care if you swim naked." I shook my head. I knew I shouldn't have worn my Fred Flintstone's boxer shorts today. The guys laughed. "Another time, but thanks for the offer." Bill shrugged. "Suit yourself." During the summer, I made a list of things I'd like to accomplish. Join a gym, find out more about my aunt who had been a union organizer, and have my picture taken in front of the Stonewall Bar where the rebellion took place in 1969. After visiting a lot of gyms, I found one in Chelsea that felt comfortable. It was mostly gay men, some lesbians, different nationalities. It was expensive, but the nice thing about having a decent-paying job most of the year is it meant I could join. Next, I set out to learn about my aunt who died in New York City around 1929. She became an organizer for the International Ladies' Garment Workers after her husband died. My father was always so proud that she merited an obituary in the New York Times. I remembered seeing it in the family scrapbook. I spent 2 weeks searching obituaries at the library with no luck. I came close to giving up, but decided to try 1930. "There's a half-hour limit today because we're busy," the woman behind the research counter said as she handed me the spool. I threaded the film and quickly fell into my routine of scanning headlines. I almost passed this one without registering its meaning. "Male butler discovered after death to be woman." My breathing slowed. I popped a quarter in the machine and printed out the article. I read each word carefully. The obituary reported the death of a servant in 1930. Her body was found in a rooming house. Her name was never mentioned. Nothing more. No diary. No clues. All I had were these few words on a page to know her by. I closed my eyes. I would never have the details of her life, and yet I could feel its texture with my fingertips. Now I knew there was another woman in the world who had made the same complicated decision Rocco and I made. Time separated me from this anonymous servant. Space separated me from Rocco. The headline chilled me, her life reduced to 8 flat words. I wondered if my life would be recorded in 8 words or less. I stared at a spot high up on the wall, feeling empty and small. Sir? The librarian's voice broke my thoughts. Your time is up. The last task I'd set for myself was finding the Stonewall Bar. I remembered the impact when we heard about the battle with the cops in 1969. I wanted to ask a passerby to take my picture in front of it. I thought someday, after I died, someone might find the photo and understand me a little better. Do you know where the Stonewall Bar is? I asked 2 gay men who were leaning up against a lamppost in Sheridan Square. That used to be the bar, one of the men pointed to a bagel shop. I sat down wearily on a park bench. A homeless man picked through the garbage can nearby. I'd seen him before. His bright African print fabric skirt brushed the sidewalk. Gauzy material wrapped his upper body, slung across one shoulder like an East Indian sari. He glided with grace and dignity. For a moment, he looked up to argue with someone only he could see. The guttural words he spoke were strangely beautiful. No one else on this planet understood his language. His hands fluttered near his face as he talked, like dark birds winging on warm currents of air. I closed my eyes. The sun was hot and high. I tried to recall what my life had been like back in Buffalo. My past already felt like a dream that receded in the moment of waking. Life in New York City shot past me every day, hurtling by like clattering subway cars. I couldn't remember a time when the world was slower and I was part of it. Screeching tires woke me from my reverie. A woman's scream raised goosebumps on my arms. I raced to the corner. "Call an ambulance," she shouted. "Hurry, for God's sake, hurry." The ambulance needn't have rushed. I knelt down beside his lifeless body. His hands were finally still. I wiped the trickle of blood running from his lip with my thumb. A gurgling sound came from his mouth and blood bubbled over his lips and down his cheek. A pool of blood spread under his head. A nightstick poked me in the shoulder. "On the sidewalk, buddy." The cop nudged me. His squad car was parked in the middle of 7th Avenue. The man from the newsstand came over to look at the body. "What's he wearing, a skirt?" he asked the cop. "Beats me," the cop shrugged. The woman sobbed. "They hit him on purpose, officer. There were 4 of them, 2 men and 2 women. The light was red. They stepped on the gas and ran him over. They were laughing." The words tumbled out, punctuated with sobs. She dropped to her knees and keened. "Oh my God," she sobbed, louder and louder. "Oh my God." An older man put down his briefcase and moved toward her. "Are you all right?" he asked. "Oh God," her voice rose. "Lady, are you hurt?" he sounded panicky. "Are you okay?" She shook her head and rocked back and forth on her knees. "Oh God," she repeated. "They were laughing." He patted her on the shoulder. "Calm down, lady," he soothed her. "It was only a bum." It was one of those muggy New York City summer nights when the temperature sticks at 100 damn degrees. I stripped down to light sweatpants and a tenement t-shirt and headed for the gym. I didn't usually go to the gym in the evening. I hated the after-work crowd lined up for the weights, but I guessed right that night. The city's population wilted in the intense heat and headed for the coolest spots in town. The gym was practically all mine. I worked my body till it felt like coiled steel and groaned when the trainer announced it was past 11 p.m. closing time. I bounded home like a panther, feeling fine as could be. As I turned from Avenue A onto 4th Street, I could see red lights revolving, illuminating the buildings, the crowd. The whole neighborhood looked up in the same direction, riveted. I walked a little slower. The street was slick and glistening. There had been no rain for weeks. I walked slower still. I heard the fire before I saw it. The hellfire roared from the windows of my building straight up into the sky. Sparks shot up like a volcanic eruption and floated down on nearby roofs. My yellow calico curtains blew between broken shards of glass as though a storm was raging inside my apartment. A small spot of flame appeared on each curtain, and they dissolved in a poof, the way cotton candy melted on my tongue. The wedding band Teresa had given me. In an irrational moment, I thought maybe I could find the cooled pool of metal on the mantle and get it recast. I imagined the pop of Millie's ceramic kitten. I pictured the water in the amber glass on the kitchen windowsill boiling furiously in the furnace of heat. I saw a small flame licking the stem of each narcissus in the glass until they curled in on themselves and exploded in brighter yellows and oranges than ever before. I envisioned Edwin's slim volume of W.E.B. Du Bois burning down the single page she had marked. Why couldn't the landlord have just told us he was going to have the building torched? Everyone knew he was having trouble selling it. Most of the other buildings in the area had been burned during the decade of gentrification. Why couldn't he have slipped a note under each of our kitchen doors this morning, warning us to take the things we loved most with us? He sure notified us promptly before each rent increase. My wallet! I left it home when I went to the gym. The rest of my paycheck was in it. More important, the only picture I had of Teresa was inside that billfold. I'd lost everything. Everything except Rocco's leather jacket. I'd brought it to the cleaners to get a zipper fixed. Abuela, abuela! A woman broke free from the arms of loved ones and pushed her way through the crowd toward the burning building. Friends restrained her. She fought to break free. What's she saying? I asked the super. He lifted his eyes to the top floor. Her grandmother. I shivered. Did he mean the old woman who could never leave her house because she lived on the sixth floor? Occasionally she asked me in Spanish to bring her bread, coffee, milk, or sugar. Showed me the wrappers when I didn't understand. Mrs. Rodriguez? I asked incredulously. The super nodded. The young woman stopped screaming when she heard me say her grandmother's name. Our eyes and our lives connected in one timeless moment. She began to sob uncontrollably. Friends led her away. I turned and looked at the waves of flame sweeping each floor, and I wondered, where do my tears go? Why is it that I can't cry now when I need to? Yet I knew that later my tears would be unexpectedly triggered by the scent of lilacs or the low hum of a cello. Eventually, the black sky lightened over the East River. I sat on the curb, my back to the smoldering building. A fine mist fell on me from the tiny punctures in the fire hoses, still pumping water into our homes. I sat very still, not knowing quite where to go from this spot. I was starting all over. I sat on a bench in Washington Square Park and inventoried my possessions. A pair of sweatpants, a t-shirt, and $20 in my pocket. All my money had been hidden in the apartment. Back to double shifts. Back to sleeping in the 42nd Street movie theaters on weekends. I had no energy. I had no choice. My mind couldn't fully accept the loss. I bought a hot dog and soda pop for $1 and walked around the park, hungry for diversion. I was drawn toward a large crowd watching a young man in a top hat and tails juggling fiery torches. This was the silly part of the life of the city that I grudgingly loved, no matter how excruciatingly hard it was to survive here. "Who would ever want to be a juggler?" the woman next to me asked her companion. "I mean, what's the point?" They both shook their heads and walked away. The joy I'd felt watching the juggler drained from my face. At the moment she'd spoken, I was thinking how wonderful it would be to learn a skill that could be practiced alone, simply for the pleasure of self-amazement. The man standing near my right elbow looked me in the eyes and cocked his head. His gaze made me uncomfortable. I wanted to turn away from him. It was as though he could see the play of emotions I was feeling. But somehow he drew me to look at him more closely. I saw a gentle man whose own feelings rippled across his face. It was as though we were carrying on an emotional dialogue without words. He raised his eyebrows in question. I shrugged. Cynics. I smiled. He shook his head and executed graceful motions with his hands. Deaf, he saw on my face that I understood. I smiled. He smiled. Then I was stuck. I looked at my hands, inarticulate at my sides. Once again, I was bereft of words, left longing for language that could speak from heart to heart. I turned up my palms and shrugged helplessly. He held up an index finger. One? No. Wait, he indicated. He examined the ground. He pointed to something behind a tree and nodded with a smile. Then he picked up an imaginary thing with three fingers. What was it? It was round. I could tell by the way he lifted it with both hands to his face. Still holding it with three fingers, he drew it back as though he was bowling, a bowling ball. I nodded emphatically. He found a second bowling ball on a branch over my head. This one he placed carefully on his right foot. He searched with his eyes for a third and found it. With a bowling ball in his right hand and another balanced on his foot, he slowly bent down to lift a third ball with his free hand. He wobbled. Could he keep the ball from falling off his foot? He did it. I held my breath as he began to juggle. I could see the heavy weight of the bowling balls, the strength required to send each one higher. His skill increased. The balls passed under one leg, behind his back, and over his shoulder. All three balls were sent high into the air. They didn't come back down. He paused and looked up at the sky, scratching his head in bewilderment. Suddenly he lurched forward and caught one in his left hand, then staggered to the right and caught another. The third one landed on his toe, sending him hopping behind a tree in mock agony. He peeked out from behind the tree and winked. It felt like such a relief to laugh. Not in spite of my grief, but because of it. We laughed together. It was deep belly laughter, the kind that brings you to tears, the kind that releases emotions thick as mud. Two men approached him from either side. He smiled at them and their arms turned in windmills of exchange. He indicated my presence. We all shook hands. Before he turned to go, he reached forward very slowly with his hand and touched a tear on my cheek. He touched his own eye with my tear, and then he walked away.